Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Anne Sterzinger. Anne, great having you back on.
Great to be here. Nice to talk to you again.
You just released your translation of it's the very first English translation of the book In the Sky by Octave Mirbeau.
Mm-hmm. It actually came out in June, but you know how slow people react to books. It's a lot slower than they react to news on Twitter, unfortunately.
I've noticed the publicity towards the book has just come out recently. I didn't hear anything about it earlier.
Yeah. Like I said, it's slow, and I have an excellent but small publisher, so we didn't exactly buy ads on MSNBC or anything, but. It's trickling out. I mean, it's the original book that I translated is fantastic. It's had a lot of influence on me as a writer because I started translating it about 15, 20 years ago. It's actually kind of a long story.
And this is with Nine Banded Books.
Yeah, Nine Banded Books, Chip Smith, an excellent crew of very odd people, and I love them all.
You speak French. When did you first read the original version of the book?
Wow, it was probably about 20 years ago. I learned French in high school. It was the only foreign language my crappy little high school up in the North Woods offered. And there was nothing else to do in Wisconsin. So, yeah, people think that because I speak French, I must have gone to some private academy or grew up in Montreal or something. But, no, I was just bored. Then a few years out of high school, I met Bob Helms, who is an anarchist from Philadelphia. And he was in contact with Pierre Michel, who's sort of the world's leading expert on this author, who lives in Angers in France, out in the West, like in the Loire Valley. He invited me to visit him out there once, which was really nice. He has a lovely family. But anyway, I'm sidetracking. Bob Helms did the zine Guinea Pig Zero, and I was living in Madison, Wisconsin at the time, and he was friends with another zinester I knew, Jeff Kelly, who did Temp Slave, which I wrote for a bunch of times. And I got to know Bob that way, and Bob was all excited about the fact that Pierre Michel had told him about this book of Octave Mirbeau's, which had never been translated into English before, which is kind of bizarre because Mirbeau was kind of a big deal in the 19th century. He wrote Diary of a Chambermaid, which has been made into a major motion picture. It's kind of a literary staple of the time, although he's been sort of forgotten in recent years.
He also had a major influence on Louis Ferdinand Céline, and Céline was someone who became marginalized as a writer because of his support for the Vichy regime. But he had a major influence on a lot of major writers, writers in the 20th century, Charles Bukowski, Jack Kerouac.
Yeah. I mean, maybe not obviously to everyone, but to my mind, Bukowski was a much better result than Kerouac, as he was, you know, more coherent and entertaining. But yeah, I mean, it's not a straight line, of course. 19th century French literature is obviously quite rich, but I would definitely be surprised if Céline had not read Mirbeau. And Mirbeau got in trouble politically too because he was a Dreyfusard. There was a scandal back in late 19th century France where this Jewish military, was he a captain or a lieutenant? God, my memory's shot, I'm old. But anyway, there was this guy was basically being persecuted just for being Jewish, and Mirbeau is an anarchist, stood up for the guy, and Mirbeau took some flack for that, and then, you know, he passed on his, you know, some of his misanthropic DNA to Céline, whose politics were different from Mirabeau's.
Politically, they kind of got in trouble for opposite reasons, but despite the political differences, their sort of their way of thinking and the psychology behind the writing is very similar.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, and basically they got in trouble for their political opinions because basically they were incorrect for the place and time. So the spirit there is rather similar as well.
I guess people get caught up in ideology, but the key thing is there's certain types of people who will just go with the grain and do what's the go with what is the conformist thing to do in that era, and then there's always going to be the people who will stand up for what they believe in, even if it gets them in trouble.
Exactly, and you know, I'm not so sure if I actually don't know how sincere Céline was in his alignment with Vichy. I haven't really looked into that much. I'm more interested in his fiction than in his politics, frankly. But yeah, no, I don't think anyone was screwing with Céline for his politics during the Vichy regime. It was afterwards when everybody's, a Monday morning quarterback.
I don't know that much about Céline's life per se, like all the details, but when I interviewed Matt Forney, he mentioned that Céline did actually publish some anti-Semitic pamphlets.
Okay. I have not read those. Like I said, as with most writers, I'm more interested in his fiction than in his politics. Which is ironic because I've done a lot of political writing lately, and I would rather be writing fiction, frankly. But, you know, not a lot of people will pay you to write fiction.
Traditionally, you've written fiction. You've kind of been writing politics. That's a pretty recent thing.
Yeah. And like I said, I would much rather be writing fiction. I'm within pages of finishing my long promised science fiction novel right now. And I'm looking for a publisher if anybody wants to contact me. I'm looking for a publisher that deals with science fiction dystopian kind of things. Because life is a dystopia. I'm going to market it as a dystopia because science fiction has become just such a clicky shit show that I want nothing to do with those people. But it does read as science fiction. I'm the kind of science fiction writer who, you know, a lot of science fiction these days is subpar because the writers don't go out and live. They're not drawing metaphors from life. They're just drawing metaphors from other science fiction stories. And a lot of the power of science fiction comes from the fact that, you know, making up your own world frees you to make really powerful metaphors for what's actually going on in the real world or what you fear might be going on in the real world. And when science fiction just feeds on itself and just becomes this Ouroboros of a scene, then it's spinning off into nothing and it loses its power.
With Mirabeau, so he was an anarchist, and there's definitely that. His views, his outlook towards society, you can definitely see it in the book In the Sky. There is this there's two main characters. One character is the narrator, and the narrator has this, the narrator is the one telling the story, but he knows this other guy who's the real man, who's basically the most important character, and after that person dies, he discovers his diary and he reads his diary. I know is one of the characters is based on Vincent Van Gogh. Is it it's not the narrator, but it's the guy who wrote the diary.
Yeah, it's X. Mirabeau just named, well, the internal narrator just calls him my friend X, but.
Did Mirabeau actually know Van Gogh, or he just sort of got inspired by him?
Yeah, Mirabeau knew a lot of impressionist painters. He was their little literary tag along buddy.
And I know another character was based on Claude Monet.
Loosely. Yeah, there are two painters in the book. They have a really interesting relationship. One of them One of them is the elder and sort of in the I'm losing track of my narrators here. I'm not sure if someone who hasn't read the book yet is going to be enticed by this, but I'm making it sound more complicated than it needs to be. There's sort of a stacked narrative, and you go from the main narrator picking up X's diary, and then X basically tells you the story of his mentor in the art world who loses his mind. And the central problem of the book is how to express the ineffable, which, you know, that's an oxymoron. So obviously the plot is headed for tragedy, but the struggle is, you know, you, like, say you have a couple of beers or what, you know, smoke pot or whatever, you know, go for a walk, whatever trips your trigger, and you see a beautiful sunset, just to take a cheesy example. You see a beautiful sunset, and it makes you feel and think particular, you know, that artistic feeling you get.
He struggles to capture it in his work.
Exactly, and he basically goes mad because of the impossibility of really communicating that, you know, that sort of complex of impressions. And, you know, it's kind of an almost post-Catholic attempt to express spirituality through art, is one way you could put it. obviously it's difficult to express, but you know, if you read the book, you might get a better idea of how hard it is to get the idea.
He's a painter or a writer?
The two sort of characters at the center, you know, when you peel back the layers and get down to the middle of the book, the two characters at the center of the book are both painters. And one of them is the younger one's mentor. The younger one is the one who's keeping the diary. The mentor, well, I don't want to spoil it, but it does get pretty entertainingly gory. Let's put it that way.
You don't want to spoil the plot at all, but I guess we can talk about the characters. So Matt Forney, his review of the book is titled Elliot Rodger Goes to Paris.
Yeah. I hadn't thought of that till I read his review, but I was like, yeah, that kind of makes sense. I actually didn't quite realize till I read that review just how much translating. Well, actually, I wrote a piece in French for Pierre Michel's Cahiers Mirabeau last year, I think it was, about how, like I said, I first translated this book 15, 20 years ago, and I mailed all the, I did it by hand at the time because I didn't have a computer yet, and I mailed all these handwritten chapters off to Bob Helms, who had gotten me into the project, and he sort of, I think he got divorced, some weird stuff happened to him, and he, all of his stuff got lost, and so my manuscript was found years later somewhere in New Zealand, which, don't ask me, but I think it was Claire Nettleton and or Bob Ziegler who dug it up. Claire wrote the introduction to the translation. Anyway, they transcribed it, and I was 19, 20 years old. I didn't even know how to write in English, much less translate. But I noticed just by reading my own old translation and all the stuff that I'd forgotten, obviously I had to fix it up a lot, but I realized just how much it had influenced me as a writer. So that review that Forney wrote kind of touched back on that. I don't think there's an English translation of the piece that I wrote about revisiting it, but maybe someday there will be. I could translate myself.
There's right. This whole genre that's been known as, it's called loser lit, and I guess a lot of your work fits into that category. A lot of Andy Nowicki's work fits into that category. I guess Celine's work would fit into that category. And that's kind of the theme, is he's just a person who is just very much the protagonist in this book, is just someone who's unhappy with his life, but he's not a loser in the sense that he's not a moron or he's not just a slacker. He's someone who really has dreams in life and he has things he's striving for, but he pretty much fails at everything he does.
Right. I a lot of these characters in Loser Lit aren't so much dissatisfied with their own lives. They're characters who kind of screw up their lives by being dissatisfied with existence as a whole. If that makes any sense.
They're existentialist.
Yeah. To boil it down. I think a lot of the bad circumstances in a lot of these characters' lives come out of the fact that it's difficult to make decisions when all decisions look bad to you. When every option looks bad, you know, when existence looks that bleak, it's hard to discern which is the best route to take. So a lot of the humor in Loser Lit is generated by, you know, people who are perceptive and smart but keep making their lives worse and worse by making stupid decisions because they don't see the good in anything or any decision.
And this also touches upon Mirabeau was an anarchist, so it's his critique of sort of a French society at the time.
Right, yeah. I mean, he did a lot of critique of the family and how, sort of neuroses and ideologies are passed down through the family. And I don't know if you ever listened to Stéphane Molyneux, the anarcho-capitalist podcaster. I was listening to him the other day talking about culture and how culture is transmitted through, you know, from parents to children and often through abusive situations in which, you know, children are afraid to disagree with their parents because otherwise they'll, you know, their brainstem is telling them they'll be abandoned. And it really reminded me of those passages in Mirabeau where he's sort of talking about how his timid bourgeois parents passed on their neuroses to him. I have no idea whether Molyneux has ever read Mirabeau before, but you know, the sort of social critique that Mirabeau was making definitely has been passed down in one form or another.
So the character X, basically, he fails at school and he's not able to make a living. So he lives with his parents, who are very kind of overbearing, and he spends most of his free time, I guess, sort of complaining about society and about other people. He resents his sisters. It says, and though I wept in a corner of the room where we had gathered in silence, I couldn't stop myself from savoring long with my tears the bitter joy of witnessing my sister's disappointment. In their eyes, I could see the death of their hopes, their suitors' escapes, and the fear of eternal virginity.
Yeah, that's a little bit of fun schadenfreude on his part. I think that part of the book, if memory serves, I think this was after his mother insists that they move to a bigger house, and then to save money, their parents just refuse to furnish it properly. Because they're such penny pinchers, his sisters have a hard time attracting suitors. Although, you know, I'm getting so senile, that might be from the part of the book after their parents die.
Okay.
But, I mean, there are several scenes where he gets some schadenfreude at the expense of his wicked stepsisters. They're not stepsisters. I'm just making a dumb Cinderella reference. Never mind me.
What are some of the things about the book that sort of go beyond the kind of stereotype of like an emo teenager like complaining in his diary?
Well, oh geez, we're in spoiler territory again.
Well, it's hard not to talking about a book. It's very tricky to get it to talk about a book in depth and not reveal anything about the plot.
Yeah, that's true. I would have to say, what really overall sets it apart is that, you know, the multiple layers of narration let you step back from, you know, getting too deep into this character's self pity and gloom, and also there's an element of humor to it that the humor kind of doubles the discourse. At one level, the character is actually making critiques of French society that the author probably thinks are fairly germane. But at another level, the author himself is making fun of the self-absorption and self-pity that people work themselves into when they're trying to, when they're trying to express everything in the world at once. I mean, some of the scenes with the painters, you know, discussing their work and discussing their difficulties are simultaneously tragic and comic, which is, you know, one of the most fun things you can do in literature. If you can make something genuinely tragic and genuinely hilarious at the same time, you've won for the day.
Successful novel really captures on everything. Something, a book that's pure tragedy is very depressing, but a book that is just, a book that's just silly, it doesn't really have that much, unless it's like really funny, that's different, but lot of comedy that lacks sort of the other qualities to it can be pretty boring in its own way too.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if I'm watching comedy that's just purely silly and there's no, you know, there's no element of tragedy or social commentary or anything whatsoever, I feel like, you know, is this aimed at five-year-olds? But if you're reading pure tragedy at a certain point, it gets to sound, like you said, just like somebody writing in his diary, which, you know, you're not doing anything to meet the audience halfway if that's what you're doing.
On the theme of comedy, like, there's just sort of generic comedy sitcoms where the people are just sitting around and they're constantly happy and everything's going good. But the most effective comedy is a theme of, I guess, getting in either, well, there's one thing, there's, well, like, I'll give you some examples, is you have Louis C.K. and he's like always really depressed. Another successful comedy show is Larry David, and the premise of Larry David's show, Curb Your Enthusiasm, and also Seinfeld, but primarily Larry himself, is that he's always getting into awkward situations and unintentionally offending people.
Right. Yeah, the Curb Your Enthusiasm is hilarious. I mean, I wouldn't say there's a huge element of tragedy in that show, but there's enough, I guess, self-criticism to give it another element. You know, he's very self-conscious about the fact that he's an asshole, and he struggles with the consequences of his own assholism. I mean, God knows if he's really like that in real life. I doubt it, but it might be a comically exaggerated version of himself. It's kind of what it comes off as.
So with the character in the sky, he also has kind of a sadistic side to him. He takes out his frustration on the world, like he finds a few people to take it out on.
Yeah, you mean X, where he's.
Yeah, X.
Yeah, when he has that romance with that poor girl that he basically just deflowers and then tosses out.
Do you say he has kind of a Madonna whore complex?
I think that was Forney that said that, but he definitely has a neurotic attitude towards sex, and you know a 20th century psychiatrist would probably draw a straight line between his sisters and the way they treat him and the way he treats women that he's interested in. You know, it's not like one of his sisters was a Madonna and the other one was a whore. They were both pretty much whores, but you know, then he imbibes all this art and poetry and he thinks of love as this, you know, flowery, beautiful, wonderful thing. until he's actually had it, and then he feels like he's sullied himself by having carnal relations, because, you know, a vagina is not actually a tulip.
He never really finds fulfillment in life. His life is just sort of endless, constant frustration. Like, either,
yeah.
Whether it's with his relations with people, or he's not able to get his artistic vision out there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think his obsession with getting his artistic vision out there is an outgrowth of his total impotence in human relations. And I don't just mean sexual impotence. I mean, you know, the narrator who starts out the book, you know, when he's setting up the frame, he's incredibly reluctant to go see X, because he basically knows what a loser X is. And he's kind of cruel to X. But, you know, once you get to know X, you kind of learn, well, X kind of deserves a little bit of that cruelty. You know, even though the original narrator is kind of a jerk, you can see why someone, well, for the listeners, let me sort of set out the way the novel unfolds. X wants this friend of his to come visit him, and he puts it off and puts it off and puts it off until he can't put it off anymore. And he goes out to visit X in the country, where he's inherited a small estate, which is, and this is where the title of the book comes from, and this is kind of the central metaphor. He has this tiny little, it used to be a greenhouse, and it's basically a little shack that's on top of this lone peak in the middle of a completely flat country. And the peak is so high and so isolated that from it you can pretty much only see the sky. Like, you're just isolated in the sky, like you're on top of, you know, just if you were living in a high rise, but you were the only person left in it, and everyone else had died, and you were on the 81st floor. That's, I mean, they didn't have high rises back then, but you get the idea. That's kind of the feeling that you get from the book, and it kind of delves into, you know, how someone can go from this incredibly idealized, everything must be perfect vision of love and art to just completely going mad, because he's in the sky. He can't compromise with the earth. He can't compromise with life. And he winds up just being completely unmoored and unhinged.
Is he a kind of a protagonist that people would identify with or not identify with, or it really depends on the person reading it?
Well, I think he's kind of a cautionary tale, and I'm sure most young people, particularly troubled young people, will recognize some parts of themselves in him in his younger days. The trick is to admit that you see yourself in him, and to, you know, be cautioned by his cautionary tale. You know, he's hardly someone to idealize, but he certainly is. He's very human. He falls into a lot of the same traps that, you see hipsters walking around now with, like, scraggly beards and ungroomed and not looking for a real job and, you know, just sort of shooting themselves in the foot over an ideal. And you know, que ça change, nothing's really changed about youth since the 19th century. And he's an extreme example, but he's definitely, you know, I see some of myself in him. I see some of a lot of people in him, but, you know, I guess the trick is to get off the peak before it consumes you, or at least to go down and visit the village at the foot of the peak once in a while. You know, have a beer with the sailors and whatnot.
Before I get on to a different topic, is there anything else you'd like to add about the book that I didn't get a chance to touch upon?
I hope I've made it clear that it's a very unique, because that doesn't make sense. But it's a unique and good read. I mean, it might make you very sad, but, you know, sometimes a good cry is good for you.
And it was unique. It was the first book of its kind, like I said, inspired all these other novels. I guess the other one I forgot to mention is I definitely, like, Michel Houellebecq writes a lot about the same theme. Sounds a lot like a lot of his characters.
Yeah, it does. There's definitely some DNA being passed along there. Well, Beck is more humorous, I guess, or there are more layers to his humor, but I guess that's what happens when you develop a genre, right? You know, later, the Simpsons wasn't as complicated as South Park, right?
Yeah. The whole genre of loser lit is that most people, when they go to movies, usually the characters, there's two types of movies. One character is about the character is very successful and lives a glamorous life. The other theme in a film is that a person maybe starts out as the underdog, but then they finally achieve success by the end of the movie, and that's basically the plot. But that's not really the case in this book.
Right, yeah. The loser lit is a little bit more realistic and a little bit more germane to most people's lives.
It's a niche. Like, you're not going to see the loser lit theme in a Hollywood film.
I would love to see the loser lit theme in a Hollywood film. Some Coen Brothers films are definitely in that genre.
I think we talked about this in a previous show in one of your articles. Like, you mentioned the sort of, like, the glamorous loser, like the drug addict who plays in a rock band and something that there's kind of that theme.
Right, yeah, that's more of a Hollywood loser, whereas, you know, the more realistic loser is drinking cheap beer in moderation after work while thinking about slitting his wrists.
Your most recent article on your site, it's called Dead David Bowie, French Nationalist Antinatalism and the Meaning of Life. So you cram all these different themes into one article.
Yeah, it's been a long week. I had a bunch of stuff to write about, and I sort of did it all at once.
So what connects all those issues together?
Search for the meaning of life, I guess. Listeners can go to my blog, annstrozinger.com, and read it for themselves. But it was basically a piece. Well, I'm trying to figure out what my stupid brain is doing when I'm an antinatalist, but I really don't want French culture to be destroyed, which would seem to make no sense on the face of it, because, you know, as I wrote, why would you care if one horde of doomed souls overruns another? I mean, I'm talking about, you know, the sort of Islamo-fascist invasion that's going on right now.
You're obviously not going to convince them to embrace antinatalism.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could, but I'm not really a proselytizing antinatalist. I mean, I realize human beings are probably just going to go on breeding until we all die of whatever consequences of overpopulation catch up with us first. It's just something for me. I can't conscience bringing some person into this world, especially not considering some of the DNA that I have. I was talking about how when in the article I'm talking about how when David Bowie died, it felt like a lot of the meaning that I've constructed in the universe for myself was drained out, because, you know, he was kind of a father figure for my generation. And it kind of helped me realize how I can simultaneously be an antinatalist and a French nationalist, a lot of elements of European culture, like the Mirbeau novel, give my life some meaning. You know, art isn't exactly a religion, but it can be very close. And you know, we're hearing more and more restriction of what Europeans are allowed to say and where and do and go in their own countries. And, you know, if Welbeck can't, you know, no longer has freedom of speech, that takes a lot of the meaning that art gives to my life out of, you know, out of my brain ham, as I put it, if that makes any sense. And as I say in the piece, I'm perfectly aware that this is just in my mind, but it gets me through the day, and I'm not particularly thrilled with the feeling of the color being drained from the universe. If that makes any sense. I mean, what do you think about the things that give meaning to one's life and how one reacts when those things are threatened?
That gets to this debate with antinatalism ties to the topic of creating people. There is for some people, it's purely spiritual, the transcendent. For a lot of people, it's culture, creating art. And I guess the fundamental question that connects antinatalism to those other issues is the premise of antinatalism is that human existence is inherently tragic. Without human existence, you don't have all those other things that you mentioned.
Right. Yeah, so it's hard to have a brain and not have some contradictions in what's in one's own thinking. And I guess that piece was just me wrestling with the contradictions in my own thinking. You know, anyone who thinks that there are no contradictions in their own thinking probably hasn't dug very deep. I guess if anything, I meant it as a blueprint for anyone who wants to examine their own thinking.
And you basically look at it, you come at antinatalism more from a philosophical perspective as opposed to the practical sort of ramification of things. Because as you said before,
yeah,
most people are not going to be convinced to go along with it.
Right. Right. And I do struggle with the whole idiocracy dimension wherein, you know, someone was talking to me on Twitter the other day about how he thought you need an IQ of at least 110 to even understand the arguments behind antinatalism, or at least to grasp their import. And he was saying, well, if people who are smart enough to grasp this don't have children, you know, the IQ in the population is going to go down. And so does that mean we have a duty to have children so that doesn't happen? I don't know. Like I said, considering some of the ailments that run in my family, I don't think the children themselves would particularly thank me.
So you were asking me, like, what really inspires me, and I guess what I'll say is my main passion in life is my art.
Okay.
And with that, like, I'm able to really get my message across with visual art in my painting, but I do, like, your thing is you get your message across through words, but I sort of struggle getting my message across of writing. But I can sort of identify with that character because I have struggled with that. Even though I've had a lot of success with that, all artists can understand that feeling of having this great vision and not being able to get that across.
Yeah, and it's, maybe it's because I'm more of a verbal person, but it seems like if you're just trying to say things with a picture, you're kind of fighting with one hand tied behind your back. Yeah, Mirbeau really, he really seemed to feel for the artists that he knew. Of course, most of them were crazy, but that kind of goes with the territory.
So you were talking about David Bowie in your article and his death, and you were making the point that what is unique is that he's one of the few artists in music that there's something kind of transcendental about his work. There's a lot of music that may be really good, but it doesn't have that quality to it.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been listening to it a lot today, actually, while I was writing. There's something transcendental, and there's also something very, speaking of, you know, expressing things, there's something very, very storytelling-y about it. And he's influenced a lot of sort of storytelling type musicians that I've listened to. Momus, otherwise, well, his real name is Nick Curry. He wrote, you know, right after Bowie died, I wrote that he was sort of a father figure to a lot of people in my generation, and intensely a father figure to someone I was very close to. And a few hours after I published my piece, I saw a piece by Momus talking about how Bowie was kind of the father of his artistic persona. And I'd never really thought about that before, but, you know, because they're from, you know, their best work was done in two different time periods, but I went back and listened to some Bowie today, and yeah, especially some of the more acoustic stuff. I could really, and other singer-songwriters I know, like the Divine Comedy, I'm sure had to have been influenced by Bowie. He kind of took, you know, the very simple storytelling of rock and roll. I mean, everyone credits Dylan for this, of course, but Dylan was still pretty simplistic. Bowie kind of made music cinematic. I've heard his line delivery described as very actorly, and that's certainly apt. You know, he didn't just tell stories, he acted them out and painted them and, you know, gave you the feeling that you were living inside of a movie. But, you know, you didn't have to be trapped in the visuals of a movie, you could be in your own life in a movie.
And it's also, he did that before, like, music videos became really big.
Yeah. Yeah, I think before music videos got really big, you were more sort of free to visualize story-centric singer-songwriters at your own leisure, which, you know, was good exercise for the public imagination.
I saw that post on your Facebook wall. You pondered the question, how many people jerked off to the film Labyrinth this week?
yeah, that was just, you know, I was tired of being sad, and so I came up with this goofy little thought, because I was watching a video called it was called Everything That's Wrong with Labyrinth, and they were just...
I haven't seen that film since I was a kid.
Yeah, me either, but there were clips of it online a lot this week, and I was looking at it, and someone in the Everything That's Wrong with Labyrinth video, they do a series of Everything That's Wrong with movie videos, and they're pretty funny.
Did you do a poll for your Facebook commentators, like what percentage jerked off to Bowie, what percentage to Jennifer Connelly, and what percentage to the Muppets?
No, but I probably should have. Maybe do that.
It's not too late. You can do that. What do you think about in that movie? What do you think about the soundtrack to the movie? Because he brings in his music, but that was also kind of towards the end. Most of his stuff was 80s, 70s to early.
Okay. Yeah, that was 80s Bowie. Nobody likes 80s Bowie. Well, Andy Nowicki likes 80s Bowie.
I like it.
I'm more of a fan of 70s Bowie, but since his death, I've had a lot of people talking me into 90s Bowie.
I like the 80s stuff, but the 90s and 2000s stuff just is not, that stuff I'm not as crazy about.
Yeah, to tell you the truth, I haven't listened that much to the 90s Bowie. You know, I started branching out in the 90s, I guess, into garage rock and stuff. Yeah, I'm looking forward to listening to more of that now. Too bad I'll never get to see him do his last album live, but I don't think he ever expected to I don't think he expected a lot of people to get to see his last album live.
So you've been writing lately for Countercurrents. You've written a number of articles there. Some of these are more political articles, more so than your other stuff.
Yeah, some of them are book reviews. Obviously, everybody loves writing book reviews. I get to get paid to read? All right. But yeah, some of them are more political. Like I wrote one called The Magical Bottomless Labor Pool, which is about, you know, immigration and the effect on supply and demand of labor, which I was pretty proud of the way that one turned out.
Oh, it was interesting about that article is you take the political issues of and economic issues. You talk about immigration, capitalism, socialism, but you actually make a connection to your book, Nuesquam, which is interesting.
Yeah. The second edition, the first edition of Nuesquam is sold out, and the second edition is going to be printed soon. And Chip Smith, who published the first and will publish the second edition, asked me to write an intro for the second edition, and it got me thinking about my protagonist, because he's not a overwhelmingly likable protagonist, and a lot of reviewers who both liked and disliked the book have talked about how he's not a very likable protagonist, and you know, my argument, well, here we go with the spoilers again, but my argument is largely you know, everybody is a bit like Lester, and some of the reason he's so nasty to his wife is because she has taken deciding who gets to make a decision when it comes to reproduction, whether a child is aborted or not.
She basically had a kid that he didn't want, and so he resents both his wife and child for that.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. And a lot of people have talked about how much they dislike him for resenting his wife and child, but his wife kind of tricked him into having that child. And you know, since children grow in a woman's body, it should be the woman's choice, because that's a very intrusive, personal thing. But at the same time, his wife was not taking his side. You know, was not taking his desires or his life into account whatsoever when she sort of unilaterally made the decision. And my argument was, you know, she gets to make the decision because that's the best of two bad choices. It's the least immoral of two immoral choices. And I, in the magical bottomless labor pool, I expanded that to deciding whether to let mass immigration happen or not. You know, you have two choices. You can leave people to rot in the shithole countries they come from, which, you know, that's a bad choice. But, and apparently our government has decided that's the better of two choices. I mean, our government has apparently decided that letting them in is the better of two bad choices. Unfortunately, the consequences of that choice are that our working class gets screwed, because suddenly there's just that much more competition in the labor market.
So you actually make an analogy, the arguments with immigration and abortion, I haven't heard those made. That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, like giving women the right to control reproduction is not 100% fair, but it's less fair than the alternative. And, you know, whether to allow mass immigration or not is a similar choice. And our government has decided that, the lesser of two evils is to allow it. I mean, I would tend to disagree, to put it mildly. But once they've made that choice, they act like it's not the lesser of two evils. It's just good. You know, kind of like Lester's wife, they've decided that the lesser of two evils is positively good, and then they take it to extremes, marching forward, just acting like it's just straight up morally correct, when it's only the lesser of two evils.
The thing with immigration is some people argue for immigration on a compassionate or moralistic basis. When it comes down to it, its primary driving force is businesses want as many workers as possible to depress wages, but also political parties want to increase their voters as well. So there's nefarious reasons behind it.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, if you want to make arguments from compassion, you can make arguments from compassion for American workers who, you know, are seeing wages stagnate, plummet, unable to find jobs, you know, and those that do have jobs have to pay taxes to support the people who can't find jobs. I mean, if you want to argue from compassion, you can make an argument on both sides.
And then you also get into the debate about capitalism and socialism, and you say that if you come to the conclusion that capitalism is not as bad as socialism, then unless you're, say, a dick with rich parents whose ideology exists to justify his trust fund, you likely believe the best-case scenario under capitalism is for the market to closely resemble a meritocracy. But the thing is, capitalism is never going to be a meritocracy, because there's always going to be people who have more advantages than others, or they have the right connections.
Yeah, I mean, it's never going to be a perfect meritocracy, that's for sure. But it could definitely be more of a meritocracy than it is now. You know, if you're going to have affirmative action in college admissions, it should be based on your parents' income, not your ethnicity.
So absurd that you have poor white people from the Appalachians who are not eligible for affirmative action. And a lot of the kids who do get into, like, Ivy League universities who are from with affirmative action, a lot of times they're very rarely from the ghetto. A lot of times they're like upper class African immigrants who are from like the elites of those countries. So it doesn't benefit the people who are the most disadvantaged.
Exactly. I forget where I said this, but I think I've described it as like giving one rich kid a leg up on another rich kid. Who cares? What are you accomplishing there?
Your other countercurrents articles you also wrote is why I'm scared of widows and orphans.
Yeah, I'm a big chicken.
Oh, this is about the refugees thing.
Right. But, oh, yeah, it was about the latest wave of Syrian refugees. Oh, right, and Obama pretending basically that the Quran doesn't say what the Quran says.
You wrote this right after the Paris attacks, because you published this. Oh, this was published December 29th, so.
Okay, yeah.
Was it about a month after the Paris attacks?
Okay, wow, it's been a long couple of weeks, because it seems like this was a lot longer ago than that. Wow.
Oh, no, I'm looking at another article. This was published December 11th, so this was right after the Paris terrorist attacks. Were you being facetious? Because most of the refugees, obviously, are not widows and orphans. Most of them are able-bodied young men.
Oh, yeah, I was being facetious. I think that headline was mostly a response to a lot of people passing around Obama's remarks about, was it Republican governors being not wanting to let refugees into their states, and he was sort of taunting them for being afraid of widows and orphans.
Okay.
So the that was kind of going around meme land, and I was like, well, you know why I'm afraid of widows and orphans? Here's the reasons why I'm afraid of widows and orphans. First of all, as you said, they aren't mostly widows and orphans. And second, you know, children grow up pretty fast, you know. Greg Johnson, the editor, to illustrate the article, he picked a photo of a bunch of jihadis wearing explosive belts, cutting
over
a kid with wearing his own explosive belt on the head. The caption is, one week they're reading the children's illustrated Quran, the next they've got a big boy suicide vest.
And then your other countercurrents article is called Applied Dysgenics. And do you get into the antinatalism theme in this article?
A tiny bit. Just a tiny bit. I'm mostly objecting to stupid people being given economic incentives to breed more.
that's sort of an interesting discussion. I mean, one idea is like there's sort of this idea of a basic income, but right now the way it's set up is like there's incentives to have kids. I mean, that's one of the reasons why if you notice, like, most homeless people are men because they can't have a baby.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like they can't produce a hostage. You know, women who don't have the skills or wherewithal or education or intelligence to get a job in the current economy can produce a hostage and, you know, be given money by the state for creating their own little hostage situation. But, you know, men can't do that, so they wind up on the streets panhandling.
And obviously, in your case, since you would never have kids yourself, that wouldn't really benefit you either.
No, it wouldn't, unfortunately. Yeah, I've been paying into the Social Security system for my entire working life, and I probably won't live to see retirement age, so it's just a net loss, I guess.
There is going to be a social safety net, then it should benefit everyone equally. It shouldn't there shouldn't be favored groups. So that, I mean, that's where the proposal for like a basic income comes from. Basically, like a basic income, like every adult citizen would get this amount of money like each month.
Yeah, I mean that sounds like a very fair idea. The problem I have with that idea is, and I've heard a lot of people talking about this, and it's extremely appealing. But where's all that money going to come from? Is the question.
One idea is that it could just replace the current money, because you would scrap a lot of the whole bureaucracy that's involved. You'd actually save money for that argument. The other idea is that money could be introduced the way money is introduced for the Treasury. So there's different proposed ways of handling it. But it would definitely it would be an improvement over what we have now.
Yeah, I mean, well, at Christ, almost anything would be an improvement. But yeah, so you're just saying they would make that the generation of fiat currency.
Yeah, that's one proposal. It's, I guess they call it like social credit is what it's called.
Okay. Well, that would probably cause the sort of inflation that, you know, would bring my math skills would stretch my math skills to their limits after a while, you know, like $5 million for a coffee. But like you said, at least it would be fairer than the current quote unquote social safety net. I've quipped before that it's not really a social safety net. It's just a hammock for people who have lots of kids.
Exactly.
In a net, it's a hammock.
Oh, you had this other article you wrote a while back called In Defense of Beta Females.
Oh, yeah, that was on my blog. That was after my one of my tangles with Rachel Haywire, who, by the way, has been harassing me again today. Although, yeah, harassing isn't quite the right word. Entertaining is more like it. She's a live one. She's been threatening to sue me for libel for exposing her scams, basically. But you know, I basically made fun of her for about an hour, and then she went off and fell into another rage spiral again. I'll probably hear from her in another couple of months.
Say, with men disempowered, there's nothing to protect shy women from being predated on endlessly.
Actually, that was inspired from some situations I've observed at jobs that I've had where women were managers, and some very not nice women were managers. And the people who really suffered in the office in that situation were the women who weren't as aggressive.
So the point making is, well, there's the whole kind of a gender war thing where you have like the feminists on one side versus the like men's activists on the other, but you're saying that different people with different personality types prey on people with other personality types, and you're saying that's more important than the whole sort of a gender war stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's. I don't have a problem with men. I have a problem with nasty people. You know, if the lens through which you see the world is men are always fucking with me, then you might be missing some of the other bipeds who are fucking with you.
Do you think some women who play the sort of gender card are very much like socially and economically privileged themselves and very kind of domineering over other women who are less...
Oh, absolutely.
Who have less dominant personalities.
Absolutely. Who have less dominant personalities or less money.
And you had those experiences when you were writing for The Reader.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I don't want to step into libel territory there, but let's just say I found out that from working at the Chicago Reader, I found out that patriarchy is definitely a terrible thing. There's only one system that's worse. Which is, you know, the obvious alternative.
So, before I wrap up the show, I guess you can, if you want to plug your next book, which is, you have no idea when it's coming out, but as soon as you get a publisher, you'll let us know.
Yeah, I definitely will. If anyone has any sort of dystopian science fiction, even a fiction slant to their publishing venture, feel free to contact me. I'll be sending out the manuscript to various folks in the next few weeks. So look for that. It's a corker.
Anne Sturzinger, it's been a great show. Thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me. Great to talk to you.
That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Bye.